they're going to try. Can you hear me? Either Williston or Dickinson?
We can hear you in Williston. Can you hear us?
Yep, we've got you.
This is Dickinson. We can see and hear you as well.
Perfect.
Okay, we'll start this in public input session for MDU rate case PU-16-666. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of North Dakota Public Service Commission. With me are Commissioner Julie Fedorchak and Commissioner Brian Kalk. We'll have some opening comments here in a moment. First of all, for the record, this is an electric rate increase case, if I didn't mention that. We're having public input sessions tonight and interactively, and there are sites set up at Dickinson, North Dakota, Williston, North Dakota, and here in Bismarck in the Public Service Commission hearing room. It's also being broadcast interactively, and people can also contact us with questions, and I want to throw out this email address right away. And I'm looking for Victor from our staff. There he is. Make sure I say this right. If someone is not at one of the three sites but has questions, you can email Victor at vshook, and that's V-S-C-H-O-C-K, at nd.gov. And that's something new we're trying, but to make sure people who aren't at one of the three larger communities are able to travel there easily, also have a chance to ask questions. Just a couple details. This is one of two public input sessions we're having tonight here. It's, by the way, we started at about 7:32. I forgot to mention that at the top of the tape. And also again on Wednesday at noon, we'll do another run through the same thing. In this case, MDU sought about a 6.6% revenue increase. We approved an interim rate increase on November 30th that became effective December 13th of 5.8%, and that is according to law. A reasonable rate increase is approved by the commission, and if ultimately the commission ends up approving permanent rates that are less than what the interim rates have been in the meantime, that overage would be refunded to the ratepayers. The ultimate hearing in this case is scheduled for 3 days. I'm thinking it maybe shouldn't take three full days, but we've set them aside, April 10th through 12th, and that hearing will take place here in the Public Service Commission hearing room. With us tonight, and by the way, for those who aren't familiar with rate cases, the commission stays neutral in these things, and we're studying and listening, and that's the point of kicking it off with these public input sessions. But we have appointed some members of our staff as advisory staff to help us understand and process the case and prepare for it. Our advisory staff includes Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco and Jerry Leon. And then we also appoint some advocacy staff who separate from us and work on behalf of consumers and ratepayers. And the advocacy staff includes Victor Shook, who I mentioned earlier, who's watching his email, Sarah Cardwell, and Jack Hsu. Those are three people from our Public Utilities Division. And lastly, I'll just say on my own behalf, when it comes to rate cases, you get a nice afternoon like today has been, and it seems like the only important thing is keeping rates low. And to me, low rates is a vital part of North Dakota's economy. We've had very low rates, both compared to other states in our region as well as the nation, for a long time, and that's both when I was in the Senate and now since coming here, to me been a vital part of what we do here in North Dakota, an important part of the link. But I would just also point out that in those first days after Christmas, when a lot of areas were devastated by a storm and people were without power in regions of the state, right at the moment, the rate probably didn't seem like the most important thing. In some of those moments, I'm sure the important thing was having a strong company with the financial resources to get trucks and equipment and supplies out into the field, hire contractors to help move snow, get things dug in. And so my goal as a commissioner is, yes, low rates, but also strong companies that can provide the kind of services that we expect and need. And so that's the kind of information that I expect to be weighing. Commissioner Brian Kalk is the portfolio holder, so I'll let him round it up last. But first of all, for opening comments, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Julie Fedorchak.
All right. Well, good evening, everybody. It's so great to be at a public input session where there's actually input from the public. So thank you for taking time to come out here. I have to apologize for this setup. I'm not sure who came up with this great plan, but I feel a little bit, when Victor is sitting there from our staff with his back to me, I feel a little bit like I just stuck my kid in the corner because all I can see is his back. So, anyway, I'm sorry that it's a little bit awkward, but hopefully we'll all get used to it as the evening goes on. I won't talk long, but I just wanted to kind of expand a tiny bit on what Randy said about how the rate cases work. So they filed their application. They're entitled by law to interim rates. And so those were provided a couple months ago, probably, or a month or so ago. This public input is one of the key pieces, and I look forward to hearing what you guys have to say. There's a deadline for interveners. Interveners will have, if there are any, and perhaps AARP is looking at officially intervening. That gives whoever officially intervenes, industrial groups, anybody could actually choose to intervene who has an interest in this case. And that gives them a seat at the table. So they have more of a role than just somebody from the public. They have attorneys typically, and they have a seat at the table. They can present testimony. They cross-examine witnesses. And they're really a party to the entire proceeding in a more formal way. And so if we have any interveners, they have to let us know. I think that deadline's coming up here in a week or so.
Friday.
And then, like Randy said, we have the advocacy staff who are separate from us that are really taking and tearing apart this application. This is just part of the application that they've provided. We've got a stack probably this high of information in my office that has been filed from the company, all the different studies that they've done and the various rate charts and all kinds of information relating to this case. The advocacy staff tears that apart. We hire witnesses to tear it apart and ask questions about what the investments are that are being made, all in the interest of the public. And so they're looking for the public's interest. They present that testimony, regardless of whether the public shows up or offers comments specific to the case. That happens no matter what, that somebody else is looking at it with a critical eye. And then it's those two parties that come to the hearing and really basically present their testimony to us, and we ultimately make the decision on what the rate should be. So that's sort of how the rate case will unfold. And in terms of what we look at in the rate making, I look at what are the company's investments in the system, and what, you know, everything from transmission to the generation facilities, the transmission distribution, the billing departments, customer service, maintenance, all of those go into their investments in the system, in the rate base. And then they are entitled to a return on their investment, and so that they're investors in the company and that they can get the equity they need to build the resources to make it whole and to make it strong and make it lasting, they need a return. And so that's the balance piece that we look at to see what's fair, what's a fair and reasonable return on the investment for the company, and then divide that whole number into an amount that ends up being rates for customers and divide that up into the various rate classes. So that's sort of a super simplified version of what we look at and how we put these rates together. and some of the processes. So thank you again for being here. This is just at the early end of this process that will probably take through the early part of the summer to wrap up. So it's a long process and thorough, and we hope it ends up being a solid decision for everybody. So thank you very much for being part of it.
Commissioner Galk.
My turn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My colleagues always do such a nice job explaining. They don't have to clean up much, right? The one thing I'd say about interim rates is that the advocacy staff already trimmed some off the interim rates. When the company filed their interim rates, it's usually approved on previous type of investments that have been approved by the commission. And there's already some back and forth where, because of work by advocacy staff, they trimmed their interim rates. So some of the things that the company may be asked for in the interim rates that didn't get, that'll become, I think, a focus of some of the discussion. But for tonight, it's really a pretty simple format. I would agree with Julie on, apologize for the room setting, but we wanted to have where the folks presenting could see the camera over here. And really tonight is the company has, I think, about 20 slides that Travis and Jordan are going to present, and they've got good attorney Paul in the middle. And if they get too far out, you got to have an attorney in the mix, right, Paul? Why are you sitting at the table, Paul? Are you going to talk tonight? Okay. It's a small world in North Dakota. Paul's dad is my hockey coach years ago, so I have to get my chance back anytime I can. But the company will present about 20 slides, and then after the company's done, that'll be the chance where anybody has any questions of the company to come up to the mic, say what your questions are, and they'll go through, and then we'll probably answer all the questions here at the Bismarck site. Then we'll go to Williston and Dickinson and answer those, and we'll be here till we're done. And you probably won't see a lot of questions out of the commissioners. Our day to ask questions is the hearing. We're here mostly to watch what happens and maybe formulate our own opinions and some further questions. But other than that, I have nothing else. So, Travis, are you kicking this thing off for the company? Okay, I'll turn it over to Travis. And, Steve, can you do your magic with the presentation?
Thank you, commissioners. Thank you for the public for coming here.
Travis, pull that mic pretty close. You have to be close to people.
Okay. My name is Travis Jacobson, and I'm with Montana Dakota. And after me will be Jordan Hotzenbuehler to finish up the slides. We do have a number of other people either at the Williston Dickinson offices or here in Bismarck if there's questions that Jordan and I can't handle. And so we just plan to do a real short presentation, just kind of give you an overview of the filing, expand a little bit on what the commissioners had talked about. And as they mentioned, we'd be available for questions at that time. So with that, I'll just give it a little overview of Montana Dakota and our operations here in North Dakota. We have about 101,000 customers. The vast majority, about 80% of those, are residential. We do serve in 117 communities in North Dakota. We have region offices in Bismarck and Dickinson, and then we have district offices located throughout the service area. We have about 570 employees that live, work, and call North Dakota home. And we do provide fully integrated electric utility service, and by that I mean that we have generation assets, power plants, etc. We have transmission facilities to get the power to the cities, and then from there we have the distribution facilities in each of our communities that we serve. And I know the commissioners covered a little bit of this, but I'll just kind of go over it again. Our initial application was filed on October 14th of last year. With a request of $13.4 million, or 6.6%. We are requesting an overall rate of return of about 7.459%. Our last general case was filed in 2010, with rates to be effective in July of 2011. The interim rate increase, as was mentioned earlier, was $11.7 million, or 5.8%. And that has been in effect since December 13th of last year as well. And as mentioned again, it is subject to refund should the commissioners find that it is the granted request is less than our $11.7 million. So why the need for the rate increase? The largest driver really is our increased investment since our last rate case. We have had incremental riders, is what we call them, and they're lines on the bill for investments that have been placed in service since the last rate case, and Jordan will cover that in more detail in a little bit. What are those investments? We have had a lot of generation investment, whether for additional power or for EPA compliance. We've had quite a bit of transmission work as well as distribution. Higher operations and maintenance expenses, that would include the depreciation on those new assets. And finally, higher taxes, and primarily property tax. As our investment goes up, so then does our property tax. So here's a little bit more detail on what our investment has been since our last rate case in 2010. And you can see there, $412 million in the area of production, so at our generating facilities. And we have added a number of different power plants, as well as invested large amounts into environmental compliance. The one thing that we have been able to do is to implement some of our renewable energy, specifically Thunder Spirit. And in that particular case, it provides a low-cost energy, which offsets purchases that we make through the market. And as everyone's probably aware, we've had an increase in our requirements since the last case. We've had, with the oil expansion in the West, there's been a number of new customers and new load that we've had to meet the capacity requirements of that. Our transmission system more recently has become tapped out in terms of the capacity and the amount of energy that it can move. And also, for reliability's sake, Commissioner Crispin mentioned the storm. One of the things that we try to get away from is having a single path to get to any particular community. So some of the transmission has afforded us the opportunity to meet the customers' energy needs from more than one place. Distribution, as our customers have gone up in numbers, we've also had to do some investment in the area of our substations in a number of the different communities that we're serving. And finally, on the line there of other work equipment, we've, with the additional work, we need the facilities to get those individuals back and forth. Williston, Watford City, both those communities outgrew their facilities that they were in. And then on the software side, our biggest investment there has been our new customer information system and billing. And that system offers a lot of information, and I'm not sure if anyone here is using it, but there's a lot of information. It allows for an individual to go in and look at their account and pay their bills online, get electronic statements, and it's a really convenient, you can get it from anywhere, so that's really kind of nice. And then just a graphic of the plant. You'll notice in the production is the most significant area, and that's the blue bar on the bottom. And, you know, I mentioned some of the projects. Heskett 3, which is a gas turbine located right across the river in Mandan. It's an 88-megawatt power plant that was implemented. We've done some environmental projects at the Big Stone Station in South Dakota, as well as the Lewis and Clark Station. And they all provide a valuable baseload energy for our customers. The compliance of those particular plants, they're all coal, and there is a cost to doing business with coal to meet the emissions standards. And finally, in the area of wind, on the renewable side, we added a 107.5 megawatt wind farm down around Hettinger, North Dakota, and that's been a good project in terms of the generation that it's provided. Another graph here, it's just kind of highlighting the type of generation, the capacity of that generation by resource. And you can see our coal fleet has remained the same since the last case. Natural gas went up. I mentioned the Heskett 3 turbine. That's the primary one there. We also have a small reciprocating engine, or a pair of small reciprocating engines in at the Lewis and Clark station as well. On the renewable side, the big increase there is Thunder Spirit. And then on the customer side, what we have tried to do was get customers to implement demand management. In other words, to allow us to have a lower peak demand so we don't have to build generation. You can see that we've a little more than doubled that category in the last since the last case. And then finally, the purchase power. You can see that that segment of our sales, segment in order to meet our sales, has decreased substantially. And by us adding the resources, and particularly the wind, that has allowed us to essentially hedge long-term on our energy purchases. Again, just a few more highlights from this case to the last. We went from about 77 to 101,000 customers, which is about a 30% increase. Sales sort of followed that same path at 32% increase. Our peak demand has also went, not quite to the same extent, about a 15% increase. The rate base per customer, I talked about investment, and that's really what this is representing, is what our investment has increased since the last case. And again, a lot of that is generation. We've had a lot of transmission build out to meet those new higher capacity, to meet the reliability. Our O&M per customer on what we call our controllable O&M, that it costs for us to provide our service to our customer. We do have an increase there. The overall rate of return that we're requesting in this case is lower than it was in the last case. And I know that a lot of people key in on interest rates, and the lower interest rates drive the equity rates lower. And the company has significantly reduced the exposure to interest through these lower interest loans that are available now. More recently now, we have seen where the Fed has increased the rate. But at this point, we've been able to decrease our return by 15%. And I'll turn it over to Jordan.
As Travis mentioned, I'm Jordan Hudson-Bueller. So he just gave a good overview of a lot of the investment dollars that we have spent in the last few years since the last rate case, and some of that investment has been recovered through the rate riders that he had mentioned. The TCA, or the Transmission Cost Adjustment, was initiated in June of 2012. And includes recovery for two large transmission projects that were completed in western North Dakota, as well as recovery for expenses that are assessed to MDU by regional transmission organizations affiliated with. Is this on? Okay. And those would be MISO and SPP. See if this one works better. There we go. Okay, and then the second rate rider that I'll point out is the environmental cost recovery rider. And Travis had mentioned the two biggest environmental projects that we had since the last rate case would be the AQCS, or the air quality control system, that was at the Big Stone plant that was pictured on one of the previous slides, and then also the MATS project, or the mercury and air toxic standards investment that we had to make at the Lewis and Clark station. And these two projects are both, they're not really by choice of the utility. We had to make those in order to be in compliance with environmental standards at the time. And we have an additional two other rate riders, the first being the generation resource recovery rider, and that would include the Heskett 3 station, which is right across the river that Travis mentioned, as well as the Lewis and Clark reciprocating engines. And then we also have the renewable resource cost adjustment, and this would include the investment in Thunder Spirit wind facility that Travis mentioned, the 107.5 megawatt facility. So over the last few years, a big part of the reason why we've been able to avoid coming in for a full-blown rate case is that some of these investments have been recovered through these riders. So that's a big purpose as to why we have the rate riders. It allows recovery between general rate cases, and it avoids the costly rate cases and provides you, the customer, a more gradual increase in your bill as we make investments over time. And looking ahead, what we're proposing to do is to simplify your bill. We're going to go from the four riders I just mentioned to just two. So the investments that are currently being recovered through the environmental rider, which was the AQCS and the MATS, those will roll into our general rates. And then on the generation rider, the investment in Heskett 3 and in the Rice units would also roll into general rates, and you would no longer see those two riders on your bill going forward, as they would just become part of your general rate. And then also going forward, we would have the two riders remaining would be the transmission rider and the renewable rider. And similar to the generation and the environmental rider, the assets that are currently, or the investment that's currently being recovered through the transmission rider, would move into general rates as well, and only the tracking of transmission services expenses from those RTOs that I discussed would be recovered through the rider on a go-forward basis. And then for the renewable rider, we would actually pull, it would continue on being the Thunder Spirit wind facility, and then we would pull two other wind facilities, the Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills, from general rates and reflect those in the renewable rider. So all of our wind generation would then be in the renewable rider itself. We are currently moving to slide 13. So on this slide, we're showing the proposed increase by rate class. And we're proposing an overall increase of approximately 6.6%, as Chairman pointed out. And it's been noted that the residential increase is higher, which is true, and I'll attempt to explain why that is with this slide here. One thing we do as part of the process in these general rate cases is we perform what's called a class cost of service study. And what that does, in part, is show us what each class of customer is returning. or what the rate of return for each class of customer is, and then that helps drive fair and equitable increases to those classes based on the needed increase in revenue. So the first column that I've labeled current return, as you'll see, municipal pumping is the lowest, and residential would be the second lowest at 3.8%. So if you recall, we're requesting about 7.5% overall rate of return in this rate case, and today the residential class is returning approximately 3.8%. So what the class cost of service study highlights is what increase would be required in order for each class to earn the requested 7.5% rate of return. And what it indicates this time is that in order to achieve that full rate of return, for instance, the residential class would require almost a 21% increase in their rates. Now, what we've actually requested in the case, because that is too high in our view, is 9.4%. And you'll see that other classes, which according to the studies that we've performed, should actually see a decrease in rates, they're still getting a marginal 1 to 2% increase. And that allows us to only request 9.4% for residential, for instance, instead of the full 21 that would be required to earn the full rate of return requested. So moving on to slide 14, the proposed residential rates. This is a breakout of essentially what would show up currently on your bill today and then what is proposed to show up going forward. And one thing to note is you'll see down on the environmental tracker line and the generation tracker, those go from having a mount to being zero because, as I mentioned before, we're proposing to roll the investment that's currently being recovered through those trackers into general rates. So the costs that are in there today, will ultimately, they are being reflected in that energy charge, the first 750 kW and the over 750 kWh. And then as you'll see, the basic service charge is proposed to be implemented on a per-day basis for administrative purposes. It's more simple to not have to prorate for customers that have a bill of less than the average 30 days or when there's billing cycles that are greater than the typical 30 days. And it is increasing from about $10 to about $19.75 per month on a monthly basis. So moving on to slide 15, which is a residential service, a rate bill comparison. And this is what we would refer to as a typical customer using an average of 980 kilowatt hours per month, with the typical monthly breakdown based on the different seasons, what their bill would look like. And as you'll see, it's right around the 9.4%. It's 9.5 in this case for the overall increase on an annual basis. And what's important kind of to point out here and in the room, I'll point it out on the screen, but right there you'll see the energy charge component of the bill is going up about $90. But then as we roll two of the riders out, the rider component will go down approximately $85, which leaves essentially the increase to the residential, a typical residential customer will just see the increase essentially to the base rate, that basic service charge that is increasing to $19.75 on a monthly basis. So overall, for a typical customer, the overall increase is about $9.60 per month. And moving on to slide 16, the interim increase was implemented December 13th of 2016, as was mentioned before. As Brian pointed out, it is slightly less than, or substantially less, a couple million dollars less than the full request for overall increase of 5.8%, or about $6 per month for a typical or an average residential customer. So your most recent bill that you've gotten, you may have seen a breakout between the portion of your bill that was covered under current rates, or what we consider current rates and for this purpose, and then the implemented interim rates that went into effect on December 13th. And with that, we'd like to open it up to public comment.
Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Jordan and Travis. What I'll do is just ask my colleagues if they have any questions or comments before we turn it over. I don't really have a question. Just could you clarify to the listening audience how it works to have a company that does business in North Dakota and South Dakota, and how you break apart your new investments on, like you build something, a new transmission line, how you break those costs by state?
Okay, I can take that. So we have what we consider an integrated electric system. So we have power generating stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana. All of those collectively are used to meet the peak demand of the customers in those three states. So we have also transmission lines, which also serve to move that power to where it needs to be. So for our transmission and generation assets, we figure out who drives the cost. So on a generating station, typically it's to meet a peak demand. So we measure the peak demand of each of our states to come up with a proportion that would go to each state that is required to meet that demand for our transmission and production assets. On the distribution side, essentially all of those assets are in place to meet the customers in that community. Those would all be North Dakota assets.
So we're not paying. So it's to clarify, I guess, what percentage of increase is North Dakota and South Dakota? I've heard those numbers before. Like when you allocate costs out, you break those out, just the big bullet items.
Yep. So on our generation and transmission, generally speaking, North Dakota is right around that 70% of the assets that ends up in their rate base or in their rates. South Dakota is around 5%, with Montana being the remaining 25%.
Sure. Okay, thank you. Commissioner, Chairman, do you have any comments, questions?
I do not. I'm ready to get into the public input session and Julie? Let other folks have their chance.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll do the Bismarck site first. If anyone has any comments or questions, or come up to the podium just so we can hear the other sites. Identify yourself and then go from there.
Good evening. Is that on? Is this on? Is it working? Okay. Good evening, commissioners, members of the public, those watching online, everywhere else. Josh Aspig with AARP. Probably easiest to hand this out quick and then go from there. I'm sure you guys will want a copy of that.
Does it work? There we go. How about that?
No karaoke, please.
No karaoke. Trust me, you the fastest way to end this public input session would be for me to sing. thank you for the opportunity to provide some public input. And for the commissioners, you know me, but for those listening and who may not, I'm Josh Aspig. I'm the state director for AARP in North Dakota. And for us, utilities are pocketbook issues for our members. And so we appreciate the opportunity to offer some comments. I'm sure there'll be others from the general public as well, and I happen to be an MDU customer as well. But on behalf of our members in the service area, we're here today to offer some comments, some things for you to ponder, specifically the commissioners, as you look at this. a factoid that I think is important to understand as to why we are looking at this and why we're offering the comments we are. Today in North Dakota, Social Security makes up 50% or more of the income for 61% of North Dakotans age 65 and older. So for 61% of those age 65 and older, 50% or more of their income is Social Security. One in three older North Dakotans rely on Social Security as their only source of income. They have no other retirement income, nothing. And so in short, utility rate increases can be burdensome as they struggle to make ends meet. And so we have four basic bullet points of things that we'd like to offer comment on, and then I'll talk about the other packet of materials that I handed out. We think, number one, that MDU is unfairly proposing those residential electric rate increases at 9.4% versus the overall of 6.6. Yes, there was an explanation of why, based on their cost of service class analysis. There's other ways that you can do cost of service class analyses, and we would question the one they used that, according to our experts, is the 12 coincident peak method. And so we think that unfairly shifts costs to residential customers, resulting in a disproportionately large increase. ARP has worked on utility cases across the country. We've seen this move by utilities to use these tactics and then claim that residential customers are somehow not paying their fair share, and we think there are alternative ways to do that and would encourage you to look into that and explore that. Secondly, this is no surprise, again, to you on the commission, but that fixed charge cost is a big deal. It's a big deal because it gives consumers a less control over their ability to control their rate increase. When you go from 35 cents a day to 65 cents a day, that no matter what, if I don't flip on a light, that's what I pay every single day. That's less control I have over my ability to control my rate increase. And we think that that is inappropriate in this instance, and we'd like to see that continue to be lower and less. The third bullet, and I'll have to apologize that if it's changed since we understood it or we read it or our experts misread it, I'll be the first one to admit I don't go in and read all of the details, but our understanding was it was a 10% rate of return. I understand it's less, so that would be great. We're happy to see that. Historically, they've been right around 9% across the country, and so if it is higher than the 9%, we'd certainly question why it would be higher than that 9%. And if it's been lowered, fantastic. The last one I would comment on, and it may seem like a minor detail, but it was pointed out, and I think it's worth noting here, is that according to our expert analysts, the company is charging ratepayers an additional $4 million a year by not being in the correct regional transmission organization. And so when Basin Electric and the Western Area Power Administration, who provide transmission service to MDU, joined the Southwest Power Pool last year, MDU was forced to buy high-cost transmission service from SPP for the first time. And we think the Public Service Commission should disallow duplicative RTO costs and require MDU to join SPP. MDU has few physical ties to MISO, and MDU is basically paying twice for transmission service in our evaluation of the proposal. So we certainly have that question and concern and an opportunity to lower that. The last is the packet. This is our third go-around, so I think we're learning. And specifically, Commissioner Fedorchuk, I know you asked about petitions last time and wanting to get them early, so we brought them today for you. There are approximately 133 of them. There were another 10 that we collected online that we determined were definitely not in the service area, to the best of our knowledge. These are all in the service area. Many of them, in addition to the brief statement that you see that we had encouraged them to sign their name to, offered their own comments about their questions and concerns, and so we wanted to make sure we provided those to you. You'll see another stack on Wednesday. I will not duplicate what you get tonight with what you get on Wednesday, so if we get any more between now and Wednesday's hearing, we'll just bring the additional ones as well. And so with that, we appreciate again the opportunity and appreciate the presentation. I think it helped us get a better idea, but wanted to be sure that we certainly added our name to the record about what our concerns would be.
Josh, do you have any questions for the company directly or any of their members?
I do not. So
this is a precursor to what they might see down the road, correct?
let's just put it this way. If you're a betting man, which I know you're not right now, but you
I usually bet in the Bison.
So. Yeah.
Not always.
Soon, that's probably a safe bet, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. All right, anyone else from the Bismarck site have any comments or questions for MDU? Okay, I won't ask again then. Wait, yes, ma'am, please, go ahead.
Just in time.
Have any great profound comments? The thought.
Could you identify yourself, ma'am, so we know?
Carol Kitko, I live here in Bismarck.
Thank you, Carol.
I was sitting here thinking I'm coming as a former teacher, average citizen, I guess, you know, and I'm seeing you guys have lawyers and offices and assistants, and I get my bill and I try to read it and understand it, and it's not that easy to understand. You know, it's like I need a footnote. I need a little guide to show me what to do. And I do appreciate, especially your comment at the beginning about the awkwardness of the room. It just made me feel at ease. I don't know, but I thank you for that. And somebody else echoed that. I thank Josh because I don't know him. I met him tonight. Because I felt, in a way, he's like my attorney. Like, you've got your attorney, you've got your office, you've got your assistant. I never met him before. But maybe I shouldn't say attorney. He is the person who's explaining it to me in terms that I can understand. I think I'm a fairly intelligent person, but a lot of these things are corporate. They're corporate materials, and I'm not a corporate person. So I appreciate, and anybody else who's going to talk, I really appreciate someone being here that I can understand. And I don't mean that as a critical comment on anybody else either. It's just I'm not versed in this kind of thing. And then speaking for myself as a senior citizen, doubling the rate to $19, I'm on a fixed income. And prices are going up all over, not just here. And it's really difficult. It's a challenge. And I'm lucky. I was talking to someone in state government who said people are coming in, and I don't know the person. I don't know what party or anything. It was by phone. But she said people are coming in and crying because they have to choose between medicine and food. And that's not your business, but it's part of it. You know what I mean? This is just one of those increases. So if you would just take senior citizens and those who are marginal for maybe no reason whatever, maybe just they have health costs or whatever, that you do take that into consideration. And I guess I do have a question. Forgive me my naivete here. When does the cost of a cost, increased cost, be taken out of profits? Does that ever happen? And I don't mean to be facetious. I'm just, you know, if MDU is making a big profit, do they ever take costs from that profit?
I'll let Travis take a swing at that because I'm here just to listen, and I have my thoughts on that, Carol. But Travis, I think, can answer that question.
And I guess it's probably...
Or maybe Jordan.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for being here, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
So when we talked about...
Maybe, Travis, start with the breakout of what is... And this is very confusing for all of us, but you've got MDU resources, then you've got MDU the utility. And I think people get... It's very confusing that what they are. So could you start at that level and then just... kind of answer it through, because I think I know where the answer is, but I want you to walk it through.
Okay. So Montana Dakota is under the umbrella of MDU Resources. With that in mind, though, Montana Dakota is completely a separate entity from MDU Resources. We do get corporate governance charges and those things because we're publicly traded, and because we're part of the group. So we do have that where there are some charges that come to Montana Dakota. Underneath MDU Resources is Knife River, which is a concrete asphalt company. Again, they're completely separate from Montana Dakota as well. So I think there's a lot of confusion a lot of times about MDU Resources and how they push all their costs and, you know, they pay for trucks and different things for the other companies. That's not true. We have our own separate line of debt, which is specific to Montana Dakota assets. And we have our own equity structure, which is specific to Montana, Dakota. So in terms of if we over-earn, where do those costs, do we ever offset any costs? In this rate case, we're asking for a return on our investment, as well as a return which will pay for the debt that's issued in Montana, Dakota's names, also cover O&M expenses, so it'd be salaries, labor. Somebody mentioned the storm outage, getting that back online, all those kind of things. It also covers depreciation. So when we build a power plant, just for instance, our Thunder Spirit wind farm, that asset, as it's used, it loses its value, if you will. So we amortize that over a period of years, and that's also included in what we're asking for in terms of the return and the rate increase. When we talk about a return, there was a 10% thrown out. If that were set at 10%, that's an opportunity for us to earn up to 10%. If we do cost savings measures, there is a chance where we may earn over that, and we file returns every year with the state Public Service Commission on what our expenses, revenues, and right on down the line, and they have an opportunity to review that. If we end up with some significant storm costs, that comes out of the bottom line, and that is not recovered from the customer. So it goes both ways. We may have a year where our sales are high and we do earn a very good return. The following year, we may earn less than the approved return, if you will. So it's an opportunity to earn that. Over the last few years, we've seen our return was in an area where we didn't feel we needed a rate case, and that has fallen significantly now. And Victor hasn't seen our annual report yet, but he'll see that come in the next couple months, and that return is far less than what we're asking for today. So does that cover your question?
Maybe repeat the question, Travis, for the people that are listening.
Within
Carol, maybe if you ask more questions, come back to the mic. But the basic question was, what's the profit that the MDU Utilities has made, and what do you forecast? I think you probably have some numbers there that you can give some ballparks.
Yeah. So in terms of where what we earned,
Carol, as he looks through that, I mean, your impression, I think, is very good. But one of the hardest things, I think, for me personally when I started here was the difference of what is MDU Resources and what is MDU Utility. What is Xcel, the company that's donating millions to Target Center, to the regulated utility? And they're regulated through the SEC, the non-utility side. But when we go through the cases, we have to – there's a strong separation of church and state in the two companies. But to your point, there is – the company sometimes does make money. And when they come back in front of us in a rate case, they over-earn, if you will. And we'll take that over-earning. In some cases, we put a collar on it where they'll have to give it back to the customers, or the next time they come into a rate case, we'll have them take those over-earnings and put it towards their future costs. So, but that's the point of them being an investor-owned utility, to where they come back in front of us, and that advocacy staff that Commissioner Crispin was talking about, that's why some of those interim rates were disallowed. They put some costs in their interim rate request that they thought should be guaranteed to be approved. The staff went through it and said, no, we disagree with these. They haggled back and forth, and they agreed to take them out. And that'll become, I think, a point of discussion. But it is a very confusing thing sometimes how the two, when you'll hear MDU Resources makes a whole bunch of money this quarter, then you go back, why the heck is MDU Utilities filing a rate case? It's just hard to compute when all you hear is MDU. So anyway, back to Travis, I guess. But
so in 2015, which is the last year of actuals, we had earnings. It was about $33 million on an investment, a rate base of about $560 million. And this is all Commissioner Fedorchak mentioned that she's got a stack of paper. It's all in that. And that's a return that is less than 6% on those investments.
All right. Thank you, Travis. Let's do this. Let's go to another site for a question, and maybe we'll kind of do a round robin here. We don't want to dominate. So let's go to, I see Dickinson, the larger screen. Do we have a, who's your rep in Dickinson again, Travis?
Jake Zettel.
Jake, do you have any questions from the audience out there in Dickinson? Or I guess any audience member?
Are we off mute?
Are we off mute?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, they can hear us.
Okay. I guess I do not, but I think there's some in the room that would like to comment.
Okay, great. If they could grab a mic and identify themselves and kind of follow the same format for the company. Yes, sir.
I'm David Steinbach. I noticed that they talked about needing a reasonable rate of return. Well, I went on the website this morning for MBU, and they have upped their dividend payout 21 straight years in a row. Now, I would think they would be able to utilize some of those funds to make these changes without making continuously big increases. I haven't made a return on my investments 21 straight years in a row. I don't know why everybody else should be able to get that. Also, they say the average household, well, I know many people who live in apartments, and their electrical rates aren't near as much as a person that lives in a house that's all electrical. So my house has got all electric heat and everything. I'm getting penalized for having a home that's all electric. My increase would be way more than what they're saying is going to be per month, just because of the fact that I have more than a one-bedroom or two-bedroom apartment that doesn't have near the requirements for electrical usage that my home does. Also, we've already paid, they had an increase last fall for the wind farm. Now, I think that's a double dip there because the government is subsidizing these wind farms, and so our government, our taxes are paying for the to build them, and then we're having to pay for them after they're built again. Somehow that just doesn't seem quite fair to have to pay for something twice. And then, not only that, we're also having to pay for the city lights and all these other things. So it seems like the residents of the communities, and basically MDU is only providing electricity in communities, to my knowledge. It would be nice if we could just vote and say, hey, we would like to have a different electrical supplier, because I know there are parts of Dickinson that are covered by another supplier, and I talked to those people who have comparable homes, and their electrical rates are half of what mine are. It would just be nice if we could have a voice in who provides our electricity instead of, we have it from MDU and we're just forced to take whatever they give us.
David, did you have any particular companies, questions for the company, or just more comments, just so I understand?
I was just wondering why the company doesn't use their investments like a business. When a person has a business, they take their profits and they use that for the investments, and then when they gain from those investments, that's what their profits are.
Okay, let's let Travis try to answer that question one at a time, and then we'll kind of keep moving here. So, Travis, can you do your best to answer that question?
In terms of the why do we pay a dividend, typically we follow what is in the investment world. The utility stock is a dividend-paying stock. We do not pay out 100% of our earnings. So there is a certain level of earnings retained that is reinvested within the company. And then in order to keep and retain stockholders, we do pay a dividend. Again, it's a fairly small amount. It's the dividend right now is about 5% on this to the shareholder.
Just as a follow-up to that, why should customers care about you keeping your stockholders happy?
I think Commissioner Christman mentioned strong companies are good for both shareholders, but also for the customer. When the company has the wherewithal to get the lights turned back on, we had miles and miles and miles of transmission line that was out. We had communities that were out. It took a lot of effort, it took a lot of resources, and it took a lot of dollars to get those customers turned back on. Does it seem fair in all cases? Likely not. But we do need to provide service. We pride ourselves in our reliability and in our ability to get people back online should a catastrophe like that happen.
But why do happy stockholders help you do that? I mean, how are those two related? Happy stockholders and providing good customer service.
We talked about our investment. I think on one of my earlier slides, our investment that has been funded in large part by the stockholders is in excess of $1.3 billion. So where do we get our money? We borrow from the bank, and we use money from stockholders' investment to get those dollars and the cash flow that goes in those large investments.
And Dickinson, to follow up with that, how do you come up with that 5% of return? If you look at banks and financial institutes right now and you invest in CDs or savings, your percent of return is not even close to 5%. So how can you guys justify that that is fair?
Could you give your name, please?
My name's Tasha Steinbach.
Thank you.
How is it fair? The investor searches out quality companies and looks for an investment that they can get a return. As a savings account is nowhere similar to an investment in stock. And in terms of stock, you can invest dollars in a share of stock, and that stock can go to zero. It can go higher. It can go lower. So there are no guarantees. Whereas if you go to a bank and you go to a CD, you're probably looking at just over 2% on a CD right now, and it's a guarantee. There's no value lost.
I want to know what bank you're going to if you're getting a 2% on a CD return.
First Western and Minot.
Okay, any other questions from Dickinson or comments? Way in the back
yes,
there.
Yes, I have. I have a question.
Let's look the lady in the way in the back. She hasn't asked the question yet.
Well, I wasn't here right at the beginning of the meeting, so there's a lot that
Ma'am, your name, please.
Oh, Betty Yost. But I do have a couple questions. One of them is, it says here that on November 30th, this commission approved this interim rate, and the commission is allowed 7 months from the date of the company's filing to issue a final decision. Well, if after they come to this decision, which might be the end of July, would we then immediately see, if they disapproved it, would we immediately see a refund? Number one, that's my first question. And number two, when you say a $6.09 a month, I do have electrical heat, so that might play into it. However, I've seen an increase of $155 a month on my bill. My next door neighbor is over $350 a month. So we're kind of wondering about this $6.09 a month.
I'll take the first question on the interim rate. You know, the law allows the company to get an interim rate based on previous type investments that have been approved by the commission. So they're given the interim rate. Our staff verified. They worked out the cost. We have 7 months in law to make a final decision. And when that final decision comes through, if the company gets zero, all the money that is paid in interim rates will be refunded back to the customers. If the company ends up getting more, then there'll be an increase that'll go forward. So that's how the interim rates work out. I'll turn it back to Travis to answer the second, or Jordan to answer the second question. Jordan.
Hi, Betty. In regards to the increase that you've seen, the $6.09 per month would be for that typical customer that we saw as for their increase. And I don't know, are you referring to just from 1 month to the next, your bill went up, was $155 higher? I think that's what you're saying. Okay.
Yes, it was 290 last month, and now it's 455.
Okay. You must have electric heat, I would assume.
I do.
Okay.
I do.
So that is probably going to be much more driven by how cold the weather was between your previous month's bill and your current one, and that the portion of the increase that was due to the interim is not going to be what drove the whole $155. I know my own bill went from $90 to $205 for probably the same period as yours. So the interim increase is really just 5.8% overall, and it'll likely be slightly higher for residential. I don't have the exact percentage in front of me, but I think the $155 increase is more driven by the consumption that was due to the cold weather and your space heating.
When you say 5.8%, you're talking about if it were a similar amount of power used. Do you have a statistic, you know, at least an estimate off the top of your head, generally, how much more would you expect a monthly bill to be percentage-wise from November to December if the rates stayed the same?
Well, I can go back to slide. I'll find the number for you. Slide 15. Can you see this in Dickinson or just on the paper copy?
Paper.
Okay,
yes,
so the
paper.
So let me know when you get to the residential service bill comparison, slide 15. Oh. Yeah, so we don't have it in front of us because a typical customer is not going to be a space heating customer. I apologize for that. So we don't have exactly what the increase would be from November, December, but we could pull something together after.
Well, I think that. Betty, Stacy is in our, she's our consumer affairs outreach lady. Could you get a hold of, well, actually, you know what, what's the best way? If you're willing to share your number across the whole world, we can take it now and call you back. Or if not, it's, there we go. There's thinking people. Randy gave out the email of vshook@nd.gov. If you wanted to email Victor your name and account number, we can have Stacy walk this through with the company and figure out exactly what to answer your question.
Okay.
And yes, spell Shook, VSCHOCK. Is that right, Victor? Yeah.
Can I add one more thing, Brian?
Always.
Betty, and one other thing that would be very helpful in your case, especially with a space heating. On the electric side, is to be a look at the balance billing, so you wouldn't see these wild swings that are largely due to weather, and then your bill would be more stable throughout the whole year. Just a suggestion.
You know, I considered that, but I think I will stay right where I'm at. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, how I guess it could get higher if it gets colder for a long period of time. I guess that's to be expected since it's, you know, where we're at in the middle of the winter. But, yeah, I guess I'm not the only one hurting. My neighbor is over $730, and they don't have a home much bigger than mine.
All right, thank you, Betty. Let's jump to Williston and see if there's any questions there, then we'll just keep going, I guess, round robin here. I can't quite see Williston real as well, but let me look at the name here. Oh, I know Ken Callahan and Shane are up in Williston. Can you gentlemen, if there's anybody in the audience, I can't see like I could in Dickinson with questions. Still can't hear Williston. One more time for Williston.
Check the volume on that thing. That should just be better.
How about this, Ken? Can you email Victor and let us know if there's any questions? Because we can't pick him up here. Okay, yeah. vshook@nd.gov, and if you have questions, Vic will bring them over. So, all right, let's jump back to Bismarck here if we have any next round of questions, sir, if you could. Thanks, Ken.
Can you again tell me what the riders? I'm looking at the difference in riders.
Stacy.
This is correct. So what are the riders? What is the exact extent of what you call riders?
Okay, was it Daryl?
Gerald.
Gerald. Gerald was asking what the extent of the rider charges are. So earlier in the presentation, I highlighted the four riders, the environmental. You remember that?
Yeah. You decrease those?
Yes, so the two are going away, the environmental and the generate.
But yet your what they call the basic service charge is going up.
Correct.
30 cents.
Correct.
So you, from 35 to 65.
That is correct.
So I have an article here that I got from the Tribune today, and it says that MDU has requested the Public Service Commission raise residential electric rates by 9.4%. This increase far exceeds the average increase for all customer classes of 6.6%. So when you're talking all classes, you have residential, you have the small user, you have the large user. Now, are the large users like out in the oil field where you have those facilities that are pumping the oil? Are they the large users of electricity? Mostly. So their increases weren't very much. According to what I saw on the charts.
Travis, I think that you can maybe answer that with, I guess, an example in Bismarck of your large customers, too.
Yeah, we have a number of large customers here in town as well. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we do throughout the entire state of North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, if we do have a large user.
Would the hospital be?
Well, the hospitals, I used to work at one of the hospitals, so I know that's, but.
You know what slide but, that is, Jordan?
Slide 13 would show the proposed increase by rate class.
And so there you go. You can see the large general, the rate increase there is
4%.
4%. Yeah. Yep.
So is that a fair increase? I mean, compared to what we're getting as a 9.4% for residential.
Well, and this is what Jordan had addressed earlier. Based on our class cost of service, you'll see that the large general there is paying about 8.1% as a return already.
Mm-hmm.
So we're only asking for 7.5. So if we followed that class cost of service study, they'd actually get a rate decrease. So, you know, Jordan mentioned every rate class is getting an increase. It was moderated so that the residential didn't get the full 21% increase.
Yeah, 21% increase. I guess what you kind of talked about MDU resources and they're breaking away from what you're looking for as far as the electric service. I know a lot of the investments that they had in Big Stone Power Plant that they took a loss on, and they had they invested in some oil wells in western North Dakota and took a loss of $984,000, I think it was. So you said this doesn't affect the electric rates. It only affects MDU Resources, the separate division of the company. But doesn't the general assets of all, the whole thing of the company, isn't it all affected? I mean, when you take that big a hit, where does it come from? Is it coming back in rate increases that we're having to pay for bad investments?
The oil wells, essentially the stockholder, which, you know, you get back to why should the stockholder get a 5% dividend versus a bank note? The stockholder took a risk in investing money in having MDU Resources invest in oil wells, and when that turned out to be not a grand adventure, the stockholder then is out. Mm-hmm. In terms of the utility customer, they're insulated from that. We talked about what makes a happy investor. A happy investor wants that dividend as a utility stock investor, and they ultimately at some point want that stock value to maintain or to increase. And so the stockholder is attracted to Montana Dakota as a part of MDU Resources to provide that for them. And they do that so that we can invest and we can meet the needs of our customers as well.
Well, according to the literature that was sent in my last MDU bill here, it says the primary reason for the increase is to increase the investment in facilities and the associated depreciation, operation, and maintenance expenses and taxes to better serve the customers. So what do they mean by facilities? Are you talking wind turbine? Are you investing in other power plants? Is this the infrastructure for the out in the west, in Williston and Dickinson and Berthold area, where there's a lot of wells that are being drilled and they need the power to run the pumping stations?
Okay, so our investment is really system-wide. In all areas that we serve, we are seeing an increase in investment, whether it's transmission to get it to the locations. Now, specifically regarding the oil wells, we have very little, if any, sales to oil pumping wells.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all served by the power cooperatives.
Power cooperative out in the west. Okay. They're not through your distribution system. Okay.
Correct.
I wanted to clarify that because I thought, well, if they're the big users, I mean, they consume a lot of electricity to run those pumping stations, so... Okay, the only other thing was that this increase of 9.4% far exceeds the average increase for all customer classes by 6.6%. Is that correct? I mean,
yes.
Yeah. So now we're getting the big increase, the residential user versus the two other classes. I mean, they're having a small increase, but
yeah, and that was the slide that we just showed.
Yeah, but is that
sir? If I could just
proportionally,
I'm not certainly making any decisions here, but the one thing that that has come out a lot is how did we get here to where the different customer classes have different percentages, mm-hmm. it would seem like they should have grown up all the same. Yeah. They got here because previous people sitting in these desks chose to have heavy utilities subsidize residential rates. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's how we got to this point. So it's it's not like they just woke up one day and there was this disparity in rate classes. And the question is, do we think it's appropriate? Do all of you think it's appropriate? Do we put those back closer together? And it's not a new issue in rate cases. Mm-hmm. So you think that it should obviously stay the same way, and that's what your point is, or the understanding of investments?
Well, I think it's a little high on the high end of the, you know, they're exceeding the they're almost a 10% increase, you know.
So if it was the same 6 for 6, 6, 6, that would be acceptable?
I would think that would be closer to be where it should be, you know.
Okay.
If you look at across nationwide, the average is around 6.6% increase, you know, I mean, for utilities. And
okay, did you have any other questions or comments, sir?
No, other than, like I said, finding out that in the western area that most of those are other cooperatives, not basically through MDU. That was one of the main reasons, because I've seen so many wells and I know what they take to run. So.
Well, we've had major transmission lines built, the mm-hmm. Basin Electric, that AVS to Neset station. Mm-hmm. That was all, most not all, but a big chunk of that was oil production. And when you looked at the power needs, the co-op's needs are off the charts. Right. Now, Williston has grown a lot in Dickinson because of it, but that's the heavy users.
That's the heavy users.
It goes to the co-ops.
Okay, that's the only question.
Julie, do you have a comment?
I have a question, actually.
I'll do my best.
Well,
chair.
It's not for you, really. It's more for the company. And it's sort of a follow-up from what Betty was asking about in the significant jump that she expressed in her bill. And then as it relates to the basic service charge. So I'm curious, the basic service charge levels out the costs that everybody pays for service, period, just so you can hook up to the bill. If you were to follow to not do that, not increase the basic service charge to everybody, but recoup those costs a different way, say through rates, how would that impact somebody like Betty with the space heating rate?
I can take that. So if the basic service charge, for instance, did not have to or was not approved to be increased and just held steady, the increase in revenue would have to be recovered through one of the other lines on the bill, and in this case it would be the energy charge. If you look at, sorry, I need to tell you what slide that is.
14.
Slide 14. So if the basic service charge as proposed just remained at 35 cents, yes, your bill to do absolutely nothing, never turn on a light switch, wouldn't go up in the sense of just the basic service charge. But if you have any consumption at all, that energy charge for the first 750 kWh, and in Betty's case, the over 750 in the winter by a long shot, it sounds like, those rates would have to be higher than what they're currently showing as proposed. So for a higher user, that would actually hurt more than the increased basic service charge. Essentially, the way it works out is that the lowest end of usage consumers are going to see, you know, a bigger jump in percentage terms, but somebody like Betty, who is at the very high end of consumption, is going to have a more minimal impact to their bill thanks to the lower basic service charge because of the lower energy rates that result. Her bill would be much higher under the proposed if the basic service charge wasn't going up.
So people with older home, less efficient windows, less efficient appliances, those perhaps electric heat, those people would suffer more because they'd be paying a higher rate for all of their usage and they're a high user versus somebody who has a new home, new appliances, maybe a bigger home, better windows, but uses less energy, that would they would pay less.
That is correct.
It would benefit them more.
Correct. Inefficient.
What about apartment people who dwell in an apartment? How does the basic service charge affect those folks? Or a retirement center, nursing homes, those types of folks. How does the basic service charge increase affect those kinds of customers?
I'll point out a slide that we haven't previously shown. It'll be slide...
The 18. Need a magnifying glass. That slide.
Oh. Okay. Well, I'll just reference it. So, for those of you on in the room here, if you look at the screen, what we've shown is on the left hand side. So, if you're in an apartment, for instance, maybe your kWh is only in that 500 range per month. And if you look all the way over to the right, we'll see the monthly bill impact based on these differing ranges of consumption on the far left. And what it shows is that at the very lowest end, for 100 kWh, for instance, that bill is going to increase about $9. And at the high end, at 1,300 kWh for the month, that bill is going to increase $7.
Do they pay the increased basic service charge in apartments?
Yes. Sorry, I misspoke there. Sorry, could you repeat the...
Does the basic service charge affect every single customer?
Yes.
Including the apartments and the...
Yes.
All the individual, every place it has an...
every individual meter for the residential service.
Okay.
Okay, Steve tells me we might be able to get Williston on just voice. Oh, we're actually calling him. Okay.
Can you hear me?
We can, Ken. It's a little echo, but I think we can make it work.
Okay, I'm going to pass the phone over to the first customer.
Hello.
Hello.
Not- Jeez. You're going to get a lot of you guys.
All right, go ahead with your question and give us some space after you talk.
My name is
Can you hear this? Someone mute their mic. Could you mute your mic? What's going on? They hang up on us? I think so.
Well, that is.
Well, it started to how come not, Gal? How come not? You know, this technology is so simple in 2017. How come our mic doesn't work? But, I don't know.
Oh, we'll put it on speaker. You guys try plugging the mic into that box directly without any cords.
Can we bring it
behind
here? We can't hear them now either, unless they're not talking. I wonder if they shut the top there, the feedback was on their end.
Dickinson, can you hear us in the Bismarck now?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, just checking to see where...
I know the gentleman in the front row at Dickinson had a question earlier when we switched and went to Williston, or tried to.
My name is Tony Garbolo, and my question is, why are you using a base rate instead of just upping the energy rate? What is the purpose of that?
Hi, Tony. This is Jordan. We use the class cost of service study, that model that we work on, and it, in addition to showing what the overall rate of return by class is, that to in order to drive the overall increases, it also shows us what the customer component by class should be to recover through a fixed charge, and the model indicates essentially exactly what we're proposing, the 65 cents a day or approximately $19.75 a month.
Why do you think that's better, though, Jordan? I think is maybe inferring more into his question. Why did you pick this model instead of just doing the other way? Is there something beneficial to the company or why you did that?
And essentially, I know there's been comments that before I even turn on the switch, the customer is going to have to pay about $20 a month. The simple fact is there are a number of investments. There's a number of costs that are not necessarily tied directly to energy. So similar to a cable bill, if you have cable, you pay a monthly charge. That's really for that investment to get that that cable to your house so that when you have that opportunity to turn on your TV, you want cable, you want it now. So for the electric business, it's very similar where there's a certain amount of investment. There's poles, there's distribution facilities, transformers. All of those are required so that we're able to provide service. So there is a separation between energy, in other words, what you consume, and what is really just the cost necessary to have that infrastructure available to get that power to your home. So that's really, I think, the big reason why we strive to get that. In terms of the larger customers, they're paying a demand component. So I talked earlier about how do we spread out our assets amongst the three states. We have to meet our customers' energy needs at that critical point when everyone's air conditioner's on and everyone has their businesses going, all of the consumers are out there using energy. We have to be able to meet that. So the large users are paying their component of that through a demand charge. So they're paying it in a different form where the residential customer, when they turn on their AC, it's hot, it's 6 o'clock, they just got home, they're gonna drive that demand, but we don't have there isn't a measurement of that the customer pays. So all in order to meet all of those demands, again, not specifically energy, to meet that peak demand, to meet that service to that customer when they need it, there's a charge that's commensurate with that. And Jordan mentioned the class cost of service. That's what that study does. It breaks it down into what is the driver in that cost, and that is the reason for the basic service charge.
Okay, any other questions out of Dickinson?
Yes, my name is John Sletmo. I live in Richardton, North Dakota, outside of Dickinson here, just a little ways to the east. And my main question is, actually I have a few questions, and the first one is going to be, who are the new customers that require the additional infrastructure? Now, it's a simple two answers here. Was it residential or commercial? Who is driving this factor of infrastructure that is needed, residential or commercial?
Thank you, John.
Two answers.
Okay, the answer to that is it is driven, our relationship between our residential customers to total customers has not changed dramatically. So we haven't picked up, somebody mentioned the oil wells. That isn't what our business does. We're primarily in towns. We're doing small businesses, some larger businesses. But the short answer is the relationship between our customer growth has stayed fairly consistent with what we've experienced in the past. So it's really on the same relationship as it always has been.
Do you have that number, Travis, a breakdown residential and customer, residential and business?
From the last case?
Yeah, just so a reference point for those listening.
So we have about 80% residential customers. I'm not sure I have the exact split at what it was in the last case.
Okay, but you're saying that relationship has not changed much in what you filed this time. So.
Right.
John, okay, John. Oh, Randy had a point.
Okay, so that, as a political speaking is concerned, you answered that perfectly. However, as a residential standpoint, that the answer did not get answered to what the question was asked. But however, well,
excuse me, John, but I thought your question was residential. I mean, what did we miss? I thought we
who commercial or residential has created the increase in infrastructure and cost, which is transferring over to the residential side? Is it the residents within this service area, or is it your small, let's use your guys' terms here, small general or large general who are requiring this additional infrastructure, which is being passed on to either the residential, and for sake, we will call it commercial for small general and large general?
Well, I guess I thought I heard the company say that the growth has been consistent, where the growth of that requires this rate case has been driven by about 80% growth in traditional customers and about 20% other, and so that's what I thought I heard, but unless I misheard that.
Nope, I would agree. It's caused by all customers.
Okay, and we were kind of originally aiming for about an hour and a half here, and we're a little beyond that. So in order to move it along, and anyway, this was a public comment, not necessarily so much the questions, and we gain from hearing your comments, the impacts it has, your concerns, and then that helps both us as well as our advocacy staff follow up when we get to the hearing. So let's try and maybe go a few more minutes here, and especially if you have comments as opposed to long questions with long answers, and try and get quite a few people's comments here in the next few minutes. And then if there's still more time, we can come back to questions. But we want to get this wrapped up probably in the next 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay. Now I'm going to hit a different main point here. As a city commissioner in Richardton, I have a main concern of this cost being added upon the residents of Richardton itself. As myself and my wife, the two residents that sit here in stance of Richardton, we are concerned as our bill continually goes up. Now, as far as sitting on a commission, we are constantly seen by other organizations that provide necessities to us citizens within this state. And we just continually see, as you say, investors get paid out. On the back of all of the residents here. Now, as I look and I see, you guys continually make money, okay? As far as your financial statements, I have not looked at every single year of whether or not you have made money or have not made money. I had just learned about this at 5:30 today from other concerned citizens that have asked me to attend this meeting. Now, with that concern being stated, is I believe it's a very large increase. When Southwest Water has made increases, it's in increments of 11 cents, and I believe providing water would cost a lot more than energy. But I may be incorrect, as I am not a professional in water or electricity.
Okay.
So
thank you,
just
John.
To state my opinion. Okay. Thank you for your time.
Williston thinks they have their problem fixed.
Okay. We'll try Williston one more time here. Victor, do we have any comments from Williston that we need that are unique?
Or? To keep trying.
Okay. give it a try, Ken.
Persistent.
Ken and Williston, can you hear me?
You could just email them.
Okay, anybody here in Bismarck? Sir? And again, you know, if we go on a long time, we deprive others from a chance, too.
I'll keep it as short as I can. My name is Hunter Andes. I'm a college student at Bismarck State College. Talking with other students, I consider myself as an advocate for college students at the college, just like AARP is for the seniors. We don't have lawyers to back us. So I live in an apartment right down the road, built in 1980. My cousin in Mandan, he lives on Main Street. That building was built in probably 1920. I'm on the third floor, southeast side, so wind doesn't hit me. And I got energy efficient windows. Since I have started living in this apartment, my bill has tripled. I have I keep my bill at 60. My cousin in Mandan, his girlfriend keeps the heat at 80. Our bill's the same. Why? I don't get it. I call MDU to ask questions. Montana, Dakota. Where do you think their customer service is? Not in Dakotas or Montana. Boise, Idaho. Not that really matters, but, you know, you go down to MDU's building, it's locked up tighter than Fort Knox. You can't talk to anybody in North Dakota or South Dakota or Montana. That would sure be nice. I'm from the Partial area. My family's from around that area. I'm served by Montreal Williams Electric Cooperative. My farm, the bill rarely exceeds $200 for the entire farm. We're talking grain bins for aeration systems. We're talking, we have propane, but we have some electrical. We have the entire farm. Never or rarely ever over $200. I mean, and Montreal Williams is one of the main suppliers of oil field electricity.
Do you have electric heat or is it gas? Natural gas at your apartment. Is it electric heat?
Electric. Okay. And I keep my electricity rates very low, or my electrical heat very low.
Yeah.
Because I'm on the third floor, heat rises. I barely even have my heater on. My bill, it's nothing compared to some of these people, $700. But my rent is $580. I'm a college student. I don't have money to be paying a $60 electrical bill plus my $580 rent when my first bill was $1,350.
And what month was your first bill from?
September.
Okay.
And I didn't use air conditioning. I never even turn my AC on. Mm-hmm. I keep my heat almost off. I mean, that's all.
The one comment, there's been a few comments about you all not having lawyers, and we certainly don't expect you all to have to pay for lawyers to come and offer your input. That's why we have these. And the advocacy staff that has been mentioned a few times, there's your lawyer right there. He's standing there in the black suit.
Like Clark Kent.
Jack Shue. He's the lawyer representing the public interest. So technically you do have a lawyer, and that's how the system is designed, so that even recognizing that the public can't spend the money on a lawyer to do that. So there's lawyers hired on your behalf to tear apart the case and ask the hard questions. So just so you know that that exists, and you're welcome to get your own lawyers if you want to and intervene. Not that anyone can afford to do that, but...
But that is the point of us having an advocacy staff that we separate off, and they go to work and work with these kinds of things and understand billings, understand company books and that, and that's what they're digging into it. They're advocating for the consumers, and that's what they do. So
they actually understand what a class cost of service study is. Because that's a term that drives most normal people crazy, including myself. And, you know, they can understand how the company, what they mean when they want to apply the return on each of the customer classes and all of this, which is very foreign to normal people. And it's not something that you deal with every day in life. So it's, you know, that's why, you know, recognizing that this is exceedingly complicated, there's an advocacy component of this that tears it apart on your behalf. So
I think the gentleman right by the door had a question, and did you not? I guess I'm not searching so much for questions. But
Jack Potter is my name. I'm a Bismarck resident. Most questions that I had have been asked, so I will make a comment that you're looking for. I'm both a captive customer, so I don't have a choice, and I'm a stockholder. And if I could get rid of my MDU stock, I would, but I'd lose too much. It's a poorly run company. And my other comment is, I don't believe MDU reads meters anymore. I believe it's all guesstimates based on past. Takes in no accounting for upgrading insulation, upgrading windows, any of that stuff.
Can I get your name again?
Jack Potter.
Thank you, Jack.
Sure.
Gerald Zittleman again from Mandan. I moved into a condo 3 years ago and became secretary treasurer. And after the first month's electric bill for our interior lights and exterior lights, which the interiors are on 24 hours a day, and the outside lights are on a photocells that turn on at dark, our first bill for that first month was $106 and some odd cents. So being an electronics technician, I decided to go in and do an energy audit and find out what I was pulling for amperage when all the lights were on. It was around 12 amps, a little over 12 and a half amps. So I went in and removed all the 60-watt bulbs and all the 40-watt bulbs and went to energy-efficient bulbs. Dropped the bill from $106.46 to around $32. Saving us a considerable amount by using energy-efficient bulbs. Since then, in the wintertime, we have one resident that leaves, and so I live in the upstairs condo, and they're gone. I unscrew five light bulbs upstairs that are not needed, just in the staircases, which dropped the bill another $5 a month by dropping those. But since then, now my bill now, with this new increase, will be over. My last bill has gone up three times already. It's gone up to $45. Now it'll go up another 10 to 55. So I'm just giving a comparison as to what the increase is.
I might be inviting you over to my place to give me some ideas on savings. If I could just go around there.
They do work. The energy-efficient bulbs do work. So.
Is there anybody in Dickinson that hasn't had a chance to comment at all yet? How about here in Bismarck? Is there anybody with a comment that hasn't yet?
I'm Brad Manns from Bismarck. My main comment is I can't see the point of investing in this renewable resources such as this wind energy when it all has to be backed up with baseload power, and then plus we're having to pay every month for it. Can you explain why you do that?
The big benefit we're getting out of that is the lower power. So the energy out of that, there is no incremental charge for the energy piece of that. In addition, we're able to get tax credits. So for every megawatt or kilowatt that's produced, we get 2.3 cents in tax credits. So the third benefit would be it's a long-term hedge on pricing. So we're able to put those facilities up, and the Thunder Spirit Wind produced about 427,000 megawatts of power last year that we were able to put into our power mix at a reasonably cheap price, and we'll have that power for some time to come. So over time, it should help offset the increases in the fuel of those that we incur.
Okay, so it's more of a money thing than a power thing, really, because about less than half the time you're going to have usable power with wind energy, right?
Yeah, our capacity is right around that 50%. So
okay.
It's more of an energy.
It's more of a money deal than an energy deal.
More of a...
Well, you're getting tax credits and you're getting money, so then it's worth it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth it if that was the only source of energy we had.
Right. It wouldn't work by itself.
Yeah, okay. All right. Thank you.
This is, I want to make one other comment. This is another point that I think is really confusing for the public. When they hear that renewable energy is going to save people money and let's invest in renewable energy, and so you expect your bills to go down, but then your bills go up. So how is this saving you money if your bills keep going up? We hear this fairly often. And so on the Thunder Spirit case, MDU came to us. They showed us if they had to buy this similar amount of energy, what they would pay for it. And so we ultimately proved it because it was the lowest of energy available at that time. And if you went to slide 7, that shows the mix of their power. If you look on the original 2010 and you see the renewable, the green, and look at the purchased power, that teal color, 110, the renewable is 55. So what they basically told us at the time was rather than spending that money buying this purchased power over here, they would invest in the renewable and it would cost less than buying that power on the market. So whether the wind is blowing or not. So when the wind is blowing, they don't have to buy the power. If it's not blowing, they do have to buy the power, but that's the balance. And so buying the wind energy is cheaper than going out to the market to buy the power. Either way, they have to have the power. So hopefully that kind of explains the what we're told is the benefit of some of these renewables, that the power that has to be purchased is cheaper this way versus another way. Either way, they need it. So,
is that because of environmental concerns as far as using coal or natural gas? I mean, because you're using the wind, which has no charge as far as what you're consuming. Like, you have to consume coal to produce electricity in the other power plants where the wind takes care of it. So that should be it.
There have been, a lot of costs added to coal. Some of those environmental costs that you're also seeing on the bill have made coal more expensive. But also, the production tax credit makes wind the cheapest. That's why it's the cheapest, because of that production tax credit.
Victor, do we have anything in from Williston? Any comments that are unique or anything like that that should be heard? Or not just Williston, anywhere they could have been emailing from.
No, so Williston just asked if they can go first on Wednesday.
we'll make that a point. And by the way, while we're on that point, so that we don't forget, sorry about the electronics hookup. It doesn't seem to be on our end, and we have typically we broadcast many of our hearings and meetings, and I don't know what's going on up there, but we do this routinely, and it works out of here. So I just don't know what the problem is. But anything else there, Victor? And we will keep that in mind, that we'll try and have this worked out for Williston and make sure they get some opportunities Wednesday at noon. Anything else?
Power supplier? Is that the problem?
I did have one email question from Michael Kuntz. How much money did MDU hand out to employees over the years since the last rate increase? I tried to confirm what exactly he meant by that, if he's talking annual raises or if he's talking total payroll. So I don't know if that's a quick number you guys can provide.
I don't have that number.
Okay. You must know, though, the average. I mean, Nicole's sitting right behind you, but the average pay raise for the employees. I mean, people get pay raises, and I'm sure you can just give a swag, because, I mean, that's an answer to the question. I think just to give a feel that your employees get pay raises, and that's fair, but what numbers traditionally do you look at?
Around 3.5%, yeah. And I guess that
Nicole is the head honcho there at MDU Utilities.
Yeah, I guess the way I would look at that is the slide that we had on the O&M per customer. When you look at that, it was about a 7% increase per customer over a 7-year period, which is about a 1% annual. So we do continue to look at ways to provide efficient operations. But in terms of payroll, it's around a 3.5 that we budget.
And O&M includes payroll and...
Correct.
Thank you, ma'am.
I just had one more from Williston. 1,000 new apartment dwellings in Williston. It seems single-family homes are paying for everyone, not the apartments. Is this true?
The apartments would have a similar rate and class to a homeowner. Just one would assume maybe typically a smaller total amount of energy used because they might typically be smaller, but they're in that category of residential, correct?
Correct. They'd both fall under the residential rate. Their consumption might look different, but they're in the same rate class.
I think the question kind of probably got to that, you know, one isn't the homes aren't subsidizing the apartment buildings, I think is probably what that question is getting towards.
No, they're not.
And I did have a clarification from my guy on the employees. His question was specifically to bonuses.
That's a different question. I don't know if you have that answer available.
I don't have an answer for that right offhand.
Okay. But advocacy staff has it now, and I'm sure it's something they'll be following up to make sure there's not excessive bonuses going on.
As always.
Thank you, Victor. One more time for Dickinson. Anybody that has not had a chance to comment that has something to add? Anybody?
I don't know.
Anybody else have an extra comment here?
Nope.
As far as a state employee is concerned, you know, when we're faced with challenges and need to find money places, it's usually the employees that receive the pay cut first. So to just kind of add it into that 3.5% that you guys give every year to your employees there. But I understand you guys work them to the bone from what I've heard, so they do deserve that. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Anybody here in Bismarck, anything else to add?
Context, but you said you were talking about utilities pay dividends. We were talking about that part of it. And you talked about earnings retained. What percentage of earnings are retained?
I believe we retain in the neighborhood of 35%.
Okay.
That goes back to fund utility assets.
And the advocacy committee is basically in your area? I mean,
well, we don't have any contact with them. They operate independently of us, but they are PSC. Yes, they're in
okay.
The PSC.
And to be clear,
they
work here, and so mm-hmm. we have contact with
right.
them on other cases, but since they were appointed advocacy staff, our discussions of
right.
this case has pretty much ended. Their advocacy, just like MDU, can't come in and talk to us about this case either.
Okay.
And so...
Is there time for between now and the next gathering on Wednesday to determine how many bonuses or what is the amount of bonuses that have been paid?
That seems like a reasonable request.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Because one of the things that, you know, the part of this public input is you ask questions, and those questions may miraculously become commissioner questions in the hearing. Just okay. That's part of the reasons that. So if it doesn't come out in 2 days, it can come out again. It'll come out in the hearing. Because the last rate case we did with MDU, I can tell you that one of the things that was very challenging was the whole how much do companies pay in for health care and how the health care costs. So when we talk about health care costs, that affects the MDU resources too. So all those things we go through, and it doesn't get the visibility maybe of a new power plant, but it's all part of, you know, they have things they have to deal with, and we look through all that.
Thank you. And I really haven't met Mr. Askbig before, but and I don't expect an answer, but it's sort of a consideration. He mentioned that there are other processes or other ways to determine these numbers that you people have had, or that MDU has had, not you people. But I'm curious about that. I don't expect an answer, but I'm just curious because it factors in then to all those determinations. So thank you very much.
And that's the importance why pretty much every state utility commission, like we are here, when there's a rate case, has some people around that are the advocacy staff. And they're also, the company, when they file a rate case, has to actually put down a deposit of some operating money to help with the cost. Our advocacy staff... maybe hiring outside consultants to help dig into these things and look at various ways. They did their class study cost, but our advocacy staff will be looking at other ways of looking at that and making sure, you know, what is the best and most fair way of doing that in one state might be different, you know, a southern state, say, from a northern state. And so that's what we'll be digging in. Bottom line, we've gone just over 2 hours now and aimed for an hour and a half. I know I've gained a lot of good insight from some of the comments and questions we've heard tonight. I'm sure everyone else has too. We'll continue this at noon on Wednesday. And all of it will be taken into consideration as advocacy staff, as well as the commission, separately prepare for the hearing in April. Anything else to add from my fellow commissioners?
Thank you for coming out tonight.
Thank you, everyone. And again, apologies to Williston that didn't work out. We'll try and get it fixed by Wednesday. We're adjourned.